Welcome inside. We turn the page to week two as the week one 5-day extravaganza is in the books. I don't know about you, but it just breezed by. The game seemed to get better as it went on. Started getting good around 4 p.m. Pacific Saturday. Saturday night was pretty good. Notre Dame, Texas A&M lived up to the hype. Was exactly what we thought it would be, literally down to the final score from our game preview. USC and LSU definitely lived up to the hype, but was the opposite of what everyone thought it would be. Not the track meet of yore that those teams specialized in. Almost 700 yards of total offense, only one turnover, only 47 points scored in the game. How does that work? Total closed at 68. Every time I looked at the screen, there was movement, athleticism, great quarterback play, but the defenses were flying around too. And suddenly you find it's 9 out of 25 on third and fourth down combined for both teams. Need to look at the all 22 on USC's defense in particular. Both teams. But I'd say USC's in particular just because of the real improvement to really appreciate the changes that they seem to have made after at least one game. You see, USC has Michigan in 3 weeks. Is that going to be a 21-17 game? I don't know. After seeing Michigan's offense this past week, it might be. I feel like Michigan is now just basically Iowa, but with 5-star recruits. It's going to be Will Johnson, Makari Page, Zaire Hill just scoring half their points this year. Michigan has Texas, though, this coming week, another fascinating matchup that's going to highlight the card, which we will reveal in just a second. We're also going to talk to ESPN's David Purdom on the back half of this podcast, the back 90%. So stay tuned for that. I think this weekend showed that we are in an era of great parity amongst the top 20 or so teams in college football, the haves of college football. But I think that it also showed that we're in an era of more disparity than ever for the top to bottom of the FBS. Texas, Alabama, Ole Miss, Ohio State, and Tennessee won against their opening week Division I teams by a combined score of 312-9. Yes, week one always has some big program blowouts. So does week two, so does week three. But something about this year feels different. Oh, right, because FBS is a crumbling facade that won't be around in 5 to 10 years. And because if you're rich or belong to the cool conferences, you have an even better chance of success than you did before. And if you're not, or if you don't, enjoy Division I, Subdivision II, coming to a failed RSN near you. So if you like watching heavyweights duke it out and don't care about how their sausage was made, you're going to like this year because there are going to be some really elite top tier matchups. I think the playoff is going to be incredible. If you dream of a G5 team cracking the playoff and making a meaningful run, or you like the idea of 134 teams all competing realistically for the same thing, you won't like this year very much. We had our first weekly winner in Robin history this past week. It was an old friend of Robin. I'm going to use nicknames here instead of full names. Our week one winner is longtime competitor, illegally detained in Moskowitz. That's a pun on his last name, Moskowitz, and an Evan Gershkovich reference, because we give out nicknames. That's what we do. Sometimes they're not very funny. Sometimes they hit, but everyone gets one eventually. Mr. Moskowitz's alternative nickname is the Night Doula, by the way, but you don't care. He won because he hit 9 of his first 11 picks. He went bold on a lot of big favorites. So not that picking favorites earns you a lot of points, but he picked favorites to win by a higher margin of victory than expected. And so therefore he was rewarded for that boldness. And he picked the right week to do that. He wrapped up the victory before the Sunday night game was even played. Kudos to Mr. Moskowitz. Came home with the $300 first prize. That will be going up in future weeks. Second and third also went to familiar Robin faces. The Dirty Duck lands in second with a free 12-month subscription to RotoWire. Not a great week for the Dirty Duck, barely beating Idaho. Nobody barely beats Idaho. Knowing him, he likely already has a RotoWire subscription. But you know what? He can gift it to somebody. And speaking of gifting, third place, the Pelequin Brief, one of the nicknames that did hit. He gets a free month Robin subscription, and he already has one. So he will literally get to gift it to someone. That 3 months, that's covering pretty much the entire college football season. Very nice gift for someone. And of course, with that paid subscription, the person who receives that gift will get access every week to the tournament. Chance to win hundreds, or dare I say thousands, in cash and prizes. Someone needs to befriend the Pelequin. Congrats to the week one winners as we turn the page to week two. You know what that means. It is time to reveal the games on the week two card. Now, initial feedback has been that 12 games for some is too many to pick. It makes sense. A lot of choices that have to be made. We will look to whittle that downward, potentially. And so we will reveal 9 of the TBD games that will be on the card here in week two. Again, the card comes out on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Did we already do the, yeah, we already did the drum roll. Don't you love it when I talk to the non-existent producer? It makes us feel so good, though, like we have one. Feel very important, very legitimate. Okay, here we go. Game number one, what else could it be? We do these in chronological order, but this is the biggest game of the week, regardless of time. All the focus is on Michigan. Big game of the week. It is the big noon kickoff. It's the big deal. Texas at Michigan, noon Eastern on Fox. Obviously, this was going to be on there. Are these quarterbacks as legit as we think they are? Matinee, Georgia Tech at Syracuse, noon Eastern on ACC Network. Georgia Tech coming out with Haynes King. Everybody thinks, okay, we got to take him seriously now. Coach Key coaching him up. O-line is revamped. Syracuse has Kyle McCord. Somebody wants to send Ryan Day a bouquet of flowers. I love that. The most boring game ever that will also be good to watch. That's what we should have called it, but in rivalry games, we use the actual rivalry title. The Cy-Hawk Trophy. It is Iowa State at Iowa. A tradition certainly unlike any other at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS. At 3:30 Eastern on ABC, the Welcome Back to the Big 12 Utah Showdown. It's Baylor going to Salt Lake to face the Utes. Cam Rising looking very good so far. Baylor supposed to have a down year. We'll see if that happens or not. 3:30 Eastern on ESPN2, a very packed middle of the day slate. Is this just because of realignment or odd scheduling? Showdown, Cal at Auburn. I don't know about you, but I had to double check, much like UCLA at LSU later this year, much like Mississippi State, Arizona State, which is late Saturday night. I had to double check a lot of these to see if they were conference matchups or not. I even had to check Texas, Michigan. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on ABC, the dominant condiment classic. Tennessee at North Carolina State playing for what is known commercially as the Duke's Mayo Bowl. If it doesn't have a Pop-Tart going into a toaster, then I don't care who the food sponsor is of a game. It's not going to be worth it. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on ABC, Colorado at Nebraska. This game doesn't have a title because we have instead given it an extremely detailed preview. It's on the site. It will be re-upped on Friday. Don't just hate watch the game. There's some legitimately awesome quarterback play on both sides of the ball. The G5 game of the week, Appalachian State at Clemson. Screams trendy underdog pick. The problem is that Clemson is actually favored quite heavily. And there's a reason for that. And that's because they didn't look like idiots against somebody random. They looked like idiots against Georgia, who will probably win the national title. So be careful with this. 8 p.m. Eastern, also on ACC Network. What a day for ACC Network. Georgia Tech, Syracuse, App State, Clemson. The ACC was supposed to suck this year. It's week two. There's time. The Ducks have never beaten the Broncos Classic. Boise State at Oregon. Last week, we reminded folks that West Virginia has beaten Penn State like twice in 4,000 tries. I was shocked to learn the Ducks have never beaten the Broncos. One, I would have thought that they would have played 20 or 30 times. Two, seriously? I believe it is 3-0 all-time Boise State, Oregon. Last but not least, late night, 10 p.m. Eastern, Fox. Get in front of a screen and watch some really gross football. The Mike Leach Memorial Bowl. It is, we barely beat Abilene Christian by 1 point in overtime. Texas Tech, Leach's school before Wazoo, at Wazoo, who put up 70 on Portland State, but also gave up like 4 touchdowns to Portland State. This is going to be gross and amazing. We wanted to make this one all quarterback props. That is your week 2 card. Again, release 6 p.m. Eastern Wednesday. Prizing $300 again. Second place, RotoWire, 12-month paid. Third place, Robin, 3-month paid subscription. We move now to a discussion with ESPN's David Purdom. David's an old friend, and he is kind enough to join us to discuss a nuance of his reporting from this past week. He has sort of been at the forefront of discussing not only the litany of NFL betting-related suspensions over the last 4, 5, 6 years, when you've seen a story about Keyshawn Boutte or Calvin Ridley or Josh Shaw or whoever. It's been David who's broken it, first of all, and David who's covered it. He has also reported recently on the NFL's new and old, but just revealed as new, procedures to help ensure betting integrity. Some of those policies and procedures have existed over the time of all those scandals. Many of them have. A few of them are new and being instituted this year because the NFL really wants to crack down on this. I'm sure they do, because it's a bad PR look for them, if nothing else. And we've written extensively about how these things are about optics more than they are about actually protecting integrity. David and I are going to get into the NFL's newly instituted policies, what they're doing to combat social media abuse of athletes, which is a rising and just gross phenomenon, whether not knowing the rules or not caring about the rules was the more dominant contributor to all of those NFL betting-related suspensions, what the new player betting education curriculum comprises, and what are the new tactics that the league is going to try to use to deliver that curriculum? And most importantly, in my view, what the hell integrity actually means when we talk about field of play, when we talk about gambling, when we talk about match fixing, when we talk about bribery, even when we talk about things like social media abuse. So without further ado, good luck in week 2. Again, Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern, check the card. Here's the conversation with David. We are joined by David Purdom from ESPN. I would say there are very few OGs in this industry that are not self-styled OGs, aspirant OGs. David is not one of those. He is actual. He is legitimate. Thanks, man, for stopping by.
Thank you, Will. We've known each other a long time. Watch this whole thing kind of take shape.
It's been awesome to see your career. I mean, not that it hadn't taken off before. It was already very, very well on its way. But obviously, like, you've really blossomed in this environment, and there's been no shortage of things, you know, for you to cover in the space, clearly.
Indeed. I feel pretty lucky that I kind of latched onto this niche early on. I enjoyed all the different stories that came out of sports betting, and it helped me get to this point. And I'm pretty fortunate, I think.
There's been several headlines recently, you know, pertaining to numerous stories coming out of the NFL. We covered sort of NFL private equity stuff on our last podcast, and we have, we've got a lot of written content on the site about that as well. One of the stories that you've covered, an additional element, has been this, we'll call it an outlining of new suspicious betting activity protections, measures, policies in place by the NFL in the lead up to the season. It seems on one hand like some of the new quote-unquote measures are not really new. One of the aspects of your story is reporting that, you know, the NFL has had investigators, ex-law enforcement, at games. They've actually been doing so since 2018, when the federal ban was overturned. Interesting tactic, and I want to get into sort of the what you think the utility of that is, and maybe where that hits and maybe where that misses when it comes to actually catching something like, quote, suspicious betting activity, which the NFL didn't define.
I mean, I think it just adds another tool, right? I think what would happen in these situations, as you mentioned, the NFL did not want to say exactly what these guys are looking for. These investigators, they're on site. Investigators don't want to reveal how they catch people, right? But it seems to me that these guys are in communication with the integrity monitors, the companies that the NFL partners with. We're looking at US Integrity, Bet Genius, Genius Sports, those guys. And those guys are watching for pretty wild line movements or anything that looks a little bit notable. If some backup quarterback's numbers all go all the way down or whatever. So, you know, they relay that information to these integrity monitors who are at the stadiums, walking around looking things. So if they hear, okay, starting quarterback, we had a rush of money on the under like we've never seen before. We never get money on this guy, and all of a sudden this stuff comes in. Well, okay, now the on-site monitor may be paying closer attention. And if he sees that quarterback take himself out of the game for kind of a weird-looking injury or whatever, a la Jonte Porter of the NBA, it might be something they can investigate in there. But I think that's only one part of their job, is to kind of look for anything unusual and part of the playing. I think they're also there to monitor everything around it and just kind of show that the NFL has a presence. We are looking for if you guys are trying to delay the clock or if you are threatening athletes from the stands. These people are looking for it, and I just think it gives them another tool they have to try to combat anything nefarious that comes about through gambling or any other measures.
Now, the NFL has had these people in place since 2018. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe that was sort of a one revelatory piece of your article, was saying, hey, not only is this something they've instituted, they've actually been doing this for quite a while. And yet over that time, the NFL has had quite a rash of, you know, gambling-related suspensions, gambling-related violations. They're not all uniform. Some of them have to do with the nuances of the league-specific policy, such as the literal geographic location of where within a facility you may or may not be placing a bet, which is unique to the NFL. Some of them are much, you know, I would say graver offenses. But there's been a lot that has happened. I think your piece mentions that there were 10 suspensions over a 3-month period in 2023 related to this issue. It honestly feels like with the headlines that there's been more. There was also the Jacksonville Jaguars Daily Fantasy Sports situation, which I still feel like is undercovered. All of this is to say they've had these procedures in place. They've had the investigators on site. They've had them physically looking for signs of something weird going on here, and yet we have had a rash of these suspensions. It's almost like she buried the lead a little bit.
Well, if you look back, though, from 2018, and we had Josh Shaw, who was a guy on reserve, injured reserve for the Cardinals, who got caught betting on NFL games. Mm-hmm. Then we had Calvin Ridley, who was away from the Falcons with some mental health leave and got caught betting on games, including some on the Falcons. And then we had this rash last year. And about half of the guys last year were related to betting at team facilities. Like you mentioned, you're not allowed to do that. Not allowed to bet in the locker room. You're not allowed to bet at a team hotel while you're traveling with the team for a game. And that one I could kind of understand, right? That's a little nuanced. Maybe my eyes glazed over during one of the training, processes, and I missed it. I made that mistake. The one I don't think there is any mistake to be made here is that you should not be betting on games your teams are involved in. And several guys did that. You're not allowed to bet on the NFL, period. To take it another step, betting on games that the team is playing in or you're involved in, nobody thinks that that's okay to do, right? I mean, everybody knows in their heart, I should not be doing that. So I think there were that rash of them. Then we didn't have any this year. So you can't prove it, but I'm sure there was some sort of deterrence factor with these other guys. Oh gosh, we should not be doing that. If we do that, we're going to get suspended for at least a year. So I think there was, while it's difficult to prove, can't prove a negative, right? But I do believe the deterrence factor played a role.
Your piece mentioned that there were some new sort of betting education efforts, right? While the gumshoes on the sidelines and in the facilities was actually older news that they were revealing, some new news has been updating their education efforts, and particularly their in-person player education efforts. Can you walk us through just kind of quickly what those efforts consist of, and do you think that the new changes to those efforts are going to provide some sort of meaningful change?
So the big change was that it was mandatory to do it in person. The league found that through its past, initiatives of trying to train these people, that the ones that they did virtually didn't quite get as much engagement with the players and maybe not have as big of effect. So the big change this year, hey, we're coming into your facility, your team's facility. A lot of these sessions were, you know, in an auditorium, and they were introduced right by the head coach, somebody that hopefully the players are going to listen to. And done that way. And the league said that, it was they added engagement, and it also gave a better avenue for guys to ask questions. When it was virtual, sometimes it didn't work out as well. So those were the two factors that they said, you know, we're going to try this. They added in some legends, some former players, Will Shields in Kansas City, a couple other guys in other cities to help kind of drive home the message. Last year before this, Tom Brady recorded a video about the, you know, what not to do when it comes to betting. So I think any big corporation, we've all worked for them. There is mandatory training. I have to do it for Disney. And, you know, sometimes I'm trying to get done as fast as I can through it so I can get on to the next story. So I don't know how effective that kind of stuff is, but the NFL's trying.
I do think that there's a lot of merit just in general, regardless of the league, to in-person education versus virtual. And you highlighted that really that was one of the two main sort of tactical points of the education that is differing. But in terms of the content of the education, you know, they're stressing never bet on the NFL, as if that needs to be said still. It's right. A little bit shocking. Never have someone bet for you on the NFL. Again, seems pretty straightforward. What's really the difference? Never share team inside information. Okay, now we're getting into a little bit of a different realm, an equally important but different realm. Never gamble while at team facilities. When they're saying never gamble while at team facilities, they mean on anything. But you can gamble on anything if you're not at facilities, but the anything can't be the NFL. And don't do it while staying at a team hotel. They are the only league that has this. It kind of taps into this antediluvian notion of if betting is physically proximate to where a game is being played, then it's bad, even if the betting has nothing to do with that game. Whereas if betting is geographically away from where the game is being played, but it's still on that game, that is okay. Not in an NFL player's instance, on an NFL game, but it has to do with this notion of betting activity being proximate to the field of play. And if it's close, it's bad, but if it's away, that's better. And I think that there's a more nuanced, digitized landscape that kind of proves that that's nonsense. Nonetheless, that was point four. Point five, never enter a sports book during the NFL playing season. Again, don't patronize a sports book. It's don't physically go into, again, physical proximity, right? Where are you physically located as a person? Do not go into a physical sports book, even though we can all go into a sports book on our phone at any point.
That's an optics thing, right? Yep. They don't want to see players walking around a sports book. It just causes, it's not worth it.
Yep.
It's not worth what it brings.
When you hear a large organization use terms like integrity or suspicious betting activity, there's not specifics around those terms. And again, she did not give you specifics for your piece. And yet this is a really nuanced issue. Integrity can mean anything to anyone really at any time that they want it to mean if you don't define it, because it's such a broad encompassing term. So going through those six policies there, it seems like already some of it's about the physical act of betting. Some of it is just the optics of proximity, as you pointed out. Some of it is about inside information sharing, or the misuse of inside information, or the disclosure of that information. which is different, right? There's nuances to that. There's nothing in here that I've seen about if someone tries to bribe or otherwise affect you or some of your teammates, you know, on field efforts or results, right? So that element of match manipulation, didn't really see that in there. The point is that this goes 1,000 different ways. And what I have found is that large organizations, the NFL included, when they're out there talking preseason about these buzz terms, they're light on the specifics. But it's good to talk about the buzz terms because it projects a certain image, right? I think good PR is allergic to specifics, but betting integrity and solving it is reliant on specifics. And there's this sort of inherent clash of those two things. What's behind why they're talking about this now and this in particular?
I think that the NFL is going to always want to show that it is working at protecting the integrity of the games. And you can question their methods, but they are trying to do something. They want to continually, and think this is a continued battle that it is not going to stop. They even said to me, it's like, hey, you know, next year we'll probably have something another. But we do feel like it's important to say, this is what we're trying to do. We're not going to get into the specifics of what they are, because again, we don't, as investigators, we don't want to tell the bad guys how we catch them. We want to keep that stuff to ourselves. So I know what you're saying. And yeah, there is a lot of platitudes and vague terms. But the effort is there. They are trying to do something. You can question their methods and whether it's going to be effective or not, but they are trying to do something. And in fact, you mentioned that there was nothing about actual what happens if you attempt to fix a game or somebody tries to. It's the fourth slide in their presentation. I just brought up the presentation just a second ago. Discipline for actual or attempted game fixing is a permanent banishment from the league. And that's one slide on their presentation that they gave. So they do try to make that clear.
Do you think, we hear about this a lot, that there's stigmas around betting for a lot of people. Maybe there is that quote unquote thought or stigma of not I've done something wrong even, but hey, someone's approached me. What do right. I do? Someone's trying to convince me to bet on their behalf. What do I do? I think I said something that I shouldn't have about an injury of a teammate. What do I do? Do you think that even at the NFL level, there is an issue of players maybe accidentally tripping up as much as purposefully tripping up and wanting and not knowing really what to do? So you can talk about don't do this, don't do this, don't do that. The penalty is this, this, and this. In other words, what are they telling players to do? What is the route to follow when one of those things happens? And is there a problem with players being willing to follow that route?
I'm sure there are some guys that exactly what just happened to you. They're sitting at the bar and a guy next to them says, oh, I heard so-and-so was hurt. And they say, yeah, but he's going to be fine or whatever. And then what they do next, they're probably like, oh gosh, should I have done that? If I tell, am I going to get in trouble? Right. Obviously you should go report it. You should say this to your team representatives, and the NFL has a team, those integrity monitor guys are there with each team, one with each team, and they're around all the time. You could locate them. You could go to your own player representative as well. Whether the players are willing to do that, you know, like I said, I could see some of them being timid. Oh, gosh, I don't want to get in trouble. I just said something just, you know, random. It doesn't really shouldn't get me in trouble, but it might. So now if a guy bets on the NFL, he's not going to go tell because he knows that's wrong, right? I mean, there's no reason for him to try to be sly there. But, you know, I'm sure it happens.
I ask this question because everything in the NFL is slower. I mean, we just did our recent, you know, private equity story. This was something that our partners over at Sportico have been covering since the news broke. I'm sure ESPN and several other outlets have covered it too. The NFL is now allowing at a very limited level private equity to get into the ownership game. that's just one example of a policy that's newly instituted that really behind the scenes has been being evaluated for years and that they've been very careful with. The final fine print on that deal about what private equity can do for NFL teams versus maybe teams from other leagues, it's very tailored. It's very careful. It's very controlled. They took a long time to get to this conclusion to allow PE in the first place, right? It's just how the NFL is. Everybody was quick to point out how as soon as PASPA came down, all of the leagues, right, rushed to embrace the lucrative nature of partnering with these companies and, quote, getting into betting. I would argue that the same could not be said initially for getting into betting education, and that some people are playing catch up. Some leagues, some organizations are playing catch up now on that front. Do you think that is the case with the NFL, especially because of all the leagues? The NFL is a little more cautious.
They certainly were more conservative in the beginning. The NBA partnered with MGM within 3 months, I believe, of the PASPA decision, which was May 14th, 2018. By July, NBA had partnered, Major League Baseball, and the National Hockey League were right after that, you know, in the coming months. The NFL, on the other hand, they waited for, I believe it was over a year. And before they even decided to partner with a sportsbook, they wanted to first partner with the National Council on Problem Gambling and our friend Keith White. So they tried to take their time and look what would be not only the most effective, but also probably a little bit, what is the best optics? What is showing people that this is what we want to do? And I think that's how that was their approach. Have they been behind on the education? Probably because of that whole the facility rule. If that, you know, that was half of the things, and it seems like that would be an easy fix or an easy something to make sure we emphasize to that. But now, you know, they haven't had any more of those in over a year. Maybe it's working.
What that rule says, again, is, hey, NFL players, you can bet on anything other than the NFL if you are of legal age. But if you walk into this room, you can't bet on anything. That room being a team facility, I should say that building, a team facility or a team hotel or a physical licensed sports book. So that is unique again to the NFL. I just want to say that as opposed to other leagues. Do you know what is behind that and what the genesis of that rule is, where that came from?
No, I don't. I always just kind of thought they didn't want people gambling at work. That's it. I don't know exactly when they thought about it and when it came to light. But I believe there has been a rule about gambling cards or whatever, roll of dice in locker rooms for a long, long time. And so when sports betting came involved, it was probably just kind of inserted into that statute.
Yeah. It sort of evokes the, you know, pre-2018 or even post-2018, we can't have a team in Vegas. Because if the team is five blocks away from where betting happens at casinos, that's bad. But if it's five states away, you know, or five counties away or 5 miles away, that's okay. Again, it gets to this odd notion, this odd fixation with physical proximity to where gambling happens when we know that it happens everywhere all the time. Now it happens in the stadium, on the phone, mid-game, you know. So it's this odd, to me it seems like an archaic notion that is rooted in an old way of thought, and they've updated a lot of what they're going after, but they haven't updated that aspect of it. And I wonder, you mentioned this earlier, I wonder how much of that actually gets just to pure optics, and if they think that those optics are what matter anymore. Do you think that from a fan's perspective, right, because they care about the integrity of the game and what that really means, is not just, is the result of this game true? Is the action on the field genuine? It means, do we have any negative perception effect here? Do people at home feel like the result on the field is somehow illegitimate? That's what they're really, really after. Do you feel like policy is like number four, right? Don't walk into this room and bet, but you can do it elsewhere. Do those impact the optics for fans in the way that the NFL thinks that they do?
I doubt it. I don't. I think that fans probably saw 10 NFL players suspended for gambling violations, and that's about as far as they dug into it. They didn't see what, you know, it was about guys betting at team facilities or on the road, or which guys were betting on the NFL. They just see that gambling violations. They probably think the worst of the majority of them. So, yeah, you're 100% right. And I've written this several times that the league cares as much about protecting the perception of the integrity of the game as it does the actual integrity of the game. And when I talk integrity of the game, and what you mentioned, this is about guys giving genuine effort out there and making decisions to try to win the game or make the best part for their team, teams, coaches, players, etc. And then, of course, referees being on the up and up and making the calls to the best of their ability. So, you know, the skepticism from social media about games being compromised has been there before PASPA, and it continues today. So I think the league just knows that something we're always going to have to deal with. We're going to try to do our best, and we're going to try to be out there on the forefront saying this is what we're trying to do as best they can.
And again, not that the NFL is going to get into this necessarily, although I personally don't think it would hurt them, but whatever. Integrity means different things. Not just it means whatever you want it to mean based on your public relations goals. I mean, literally, it means there are many different prongs of integrity. There is the literal integrity of the betting market itself, almost like financial fraud, right? Is somebody manipulating the market with trades or steam on one side? Are they dumping money on, you know, one side of a binary market to move it to a certain price for some bad aim, right? There's the match manipulation aspect of integrity. And that is, are people talking to players? Are they talking to coaches? Is someone, for some reason, maybe the player or coach themselves, willing to or being made willing to affect the outcome of a game where it wouldn't naturally be that way? And enter, you know, Jontay Porter. That's an NBA example, but you covered that, you know, sort of to death, right? And, you know, and then there's the whole inside information, the misuse of inside info, right? Where we're not affecting what players are doing. We're not trying to manipulate the, you know, we're not trying to change what the outcome could be to something else. We're saying we know information, and therefore the public doesn't know this, but therefore we think that the outcome is much more likely to be this based on something that only we know. And we're going to manipulate that to our financial advantage. There are many other aspects of integrity, but those are just three prongs. But when a league talks about ensuring that, they don't say which one of those they're referring to. And obviously they want to catch all of it. I just think it's a more nuanced issue and topic for the reasons just laid out. And so it's hard to know, especially with any league that has had a rash of suspensions like that, are you hitting all the marks?
I think that, number one, they want to make sure the on-field activity is on the up and up and as genuine as possible. The inside information is probably their second fear. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the next betting scandal, whether it be in the NFL or another league. We find out a trainer was leaking stuff to, you know, professional gamblers or whatever. And, you know, that seems very, very difficult to detect and to catch. So I wouldn't be surprised. It wouldn't surprise me if that's what we saw.
My reason for asking about, you know, things in the NFL being slower, were they kind of behind on the education front, is really to ask this question, because you've covered, again, the NFL gambling suspensions more than most. In your opinion, which of these two factors was the greater factor that contributed to NFL gambling violations? Was it that more players on the balance were just simply not aware of the rules, or do you think that more players were aware of the rules and they felt they wouldn't get caught?
It's almost a dead even split, because if, again, I go back and if I look at the guys who were betting on facilities, I can understand how they may have missed that part, and that may have been a genuine mistake. I didn't know I wasn't allowed to bet on this. Then the other 50% of the guys who were betting on the NFL and the guys that are betting on games they were involved in or their teams were involved in, they were blatantly breaking the rules, in my opinion, knowingly breaking the rules. I don't think any of them said, I'm sure it's okay if I bet on NFL games. I just don't think that's anywhere anyone could possibly hit that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very split right down the middle.
one of the 6 points that are mentioned in sort of the new bullets, the new, I'll put it in quotes, of the NFL's betting education efforts, never have somebody bet for you on the NFL. I certainly won't put words or accusations in your mouth. It is my personal understanding that multiple of these NFL gambling violations, two come to mind in particular, had to do with players who either were directly asking a relative, friend, family member whose personal information they happen to have at their disposal, which is what you need to gamble at a registered, legalized online site, such as, you know, a DraftKings or a FanDuel if you set up an account. It's my understanding that at least two of these violations involve players who were having a friend, family member, whatever, bet on their behalf and or were just utilizing the identity of that friend and family member to do so themselves. Not dissimilar to a Jontay Porter, one of the aspects of the Jontay Porter case too. That to me is a very nefarious point, because if you don't drill down into the exact specifics of what that means, right? No motivational Tom Brady video, I think, is necessarily going to get that across. I think it's easier to say to people, you can't bet on the NFL, period. That's blunt. That's simple. If it's, you know, you can have an account with a sports book, but it's got to be your information. But that account with your information, you can't use that to bet on the NFL, but you can bet with other stuff. And if you have a family member, they can't bet on the NFL if it's for you, but maybe they can bet on the NFL if it's for them. But there's real shades of gray there. Do you think that specific aspect, right, players not betting themselves, but a family member or someone that they're close to, maybe someone whose account they might have access to, do you think that poses an increasing risk going forward, whereas some of these other things are more binary?
Definitely. Simply because it's so hard to defend. You can, you know, just, hey, place this bet for me. Nobody's ever going to know. You know, let's say for some reason track it down and have some sort of recording or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be very, very challenging to stop. But I would think that goes into this division that we said of people betting, doing something that they know is wrong. They're willingly breaking the rules. If they're telling somebody, a family member, to bet on the NFL, I don't think they're saying, I bet if I have them place it, it'll be okay. I think they know that that's wrong. So I think whenever you have guys that are just willing to break the rules and knowingly break them, it's just very, very challenging. And it comes down ultimately to deterrence, because you're not going to be able to stop that. It's going to be very challenging to have any kind of progress or help with that. But you can, if you are to catch them, you can deter them and hope that it kind of resonates with the other people.
One of the other aspects that you covered in your article, and again, we talk about the blurring of the definition of integrity, and it's certainly no fault of the article, because you were reporting the information you were given, but sort of tapped under as one little tendril of that bucket of integrity is athlete abuse. You reported that, you know, they're instituting new policies in place to help identify this. Can you talk about what those procedures consist of? Because this is an increasing problem, people getting harassed on social media.
You know, they're not going to tell me exactly how they go about it, but there have been some implementation of facial recognition at NFL stadiums that, along with the on-site integrity monitors, maybe they hear it, maybe the player hears it and points to that person, and then they can go back and get video evidence and maybe try to identify those people. And when they do, then they take it to law enforcement. So it's part of the, quote, the integrity representative's job is to establish contact with local law enforcement and federal law enforcement to try to go after these people, because it is a sickening problem, in my opinion. It's really disturbing, and it's very difficult to stop. I don't think we will ever stop it, but I do think we can decrease it. We can do some things and fight back. And if some of these guys that do this, you know, let me stop there. One of my biggest things with this deal is we never hear the names of the people that are threatening. And so why do they even care? It just seems to me like there should be some sort of public shaming. If you cannot handle losing a bet, so that's where you threaten somebody's family member, it's pretty crazy.
No doubt.
We do not know the exact processes. We only know some of the tools that they have at their
disposal. And I wanted to ask you, speaking of specific names, I wanted to ask you exactly about that. Do we have any specific examples, maybe convictions to date of people that have broken criminal laws and not just become a jackass, but actually violated law, violated statute in some way? Examples of those sorts of people that we can point to show that, hey, this process is working, or this person did that. Here's the consequence. What examples do we have?
Benjamin Patz, guy named Parley Patz, this young kid. He's the most high profile example. This was 4 or 5 years ago. He was just sending these awful direct messages to players, including Rob Gronkowski, multiple Patriots players. It was before the Patriots-Rams game. And the apparent goal of this was he was trying to get inside their heads. And I mean, some of these things, I won't even say it, repeat them. They are so vile and so gross. And he would try to get into their heads. And then his thought was, I'm going to bet against them. And, you know, so if he would try to make, you know, get into the Patriots' heads, he would be going to bet on the Rams in the Super Bowl. And he did get convicted. And, you know, I believe it was a probationary sentence, if I remember correctly, which didn't seem extreme enough to me. At the time. But that is one example. That's the prime example. But we haven't heard a lot. And we have states creating these laws that prohibit this and will ban you from being able to use the legal betting market if you were found to have threatened athletes because of betting purposes. But we don't see these lists. We don't see these names. So we don't know how many people are on these lists and you know, what their actual penalty is. So I hope we see more and more states take this seriously. The NCAA is certainly taking it seriously. I spoke to them this week, and they're still just appalled by this. They're trying to figure out what they can do. Their approach has been, hey, we're not gonna, we want to prohibit prop bets on college athletes. You know, maybe that decreases it a little. I don't know. But I think there are things they can do that are really around that deterrence factor again. That can hopefully decrease these episodes. It's terrible to me. It breaks my heart.
What is a win on integrity? And I'm going to leave the term as broadly defined as they do. I'll just throw everything in the bucket. What is a win this year for the NFL on integrity? Be it suspicious activity, be it match fixing, be it inside information, be it social media abuse. Other than just, well, I didn't hear any headlines, so I guess things are business as usual. What does success look like for a league like the NFL?
I think the signs of the education process is working, that people are understanding the rules better and to prevent them from getting in trouble. Obviously, if there are no headlines, that is certainly something that they can hang their hat on. Hey, we didn't have any today or this week or this season. And I think the number one thing is they just don't want any game to be manipulated. And we've mentioned Jonte Porter, former Toronto Raptors player in the NBA, who was the first person to be convicted, plead guilty to actually manipulating his play in a game for gambling purposes. And those are, to me, are the most serious of serious integrity threats. The rest of it, yes, but I don't think that the manipulating a game for gambling purposes is always, in my opinion, going to be the most serious crime in all this. And so trying to keep, I don't know if you can prevent them, but trying your best to prevent them, I guess, is a win.
Yeah. Jonte Porter obviously is the holy grail of holy shit. The worst of the worst, and not just the worst of the worst because that harms or potentially harms the integrity of the NBA's games, not just what a deplorable action from a player himself. It's also, in my opinion, probably a not very popular one, but I think it's the worst of the worst from the sportsbook's perspective, because how was this caught? This was caught by legal regulated sportsbooks, but it happened several years ago. Well, parts of this process with Jonte, and we don't need to get into the specifics of it, happened several years ago, and it's questionable whether or not Jonte did some of this with his own account in his name or whether it was with somebody else's account, whether the bets were placed when he was not with the league at all, or with the G League, which is part of the NBA, but not the NBA, or when he was with the Raptors. There's a lot of shades of nuance of this that can kind of cloak exactly how bad it was. But this happened a long time ago, and it was with the people that are supposed to catch it, the people that have oversight, the people that have scrutiny, and probably the people that knew at least something, right? And yet it comes out now.
The one thing I would add is that, and I've written about this, some of the limits that are being taken on bets, like same game parlays on Jontay Porter under all his statistics, are insane. An $80,000 parlay bet on all Jontay under Porter unders should never, ever even be close to being offered. Sure. And the fact that it is, it almost incentivizes these guys to take these chances. Yeah. You can offer any bet you want, but if your limit is $5 or $10, you are pretty much eliminating any chance that there will be hardcore nefarious activity. But to offer $80,000 and these giant parlay bets, it's absurd to me. It goes against everything they say when they start talking about integrity of the games.